This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte.
We've got some news this week, not only from Washington, but a little from Indianapolis, too, on how things are coming along with the South Shore Line's projects, in particular the double-tracking Northwest Indiana project and, of course, the Westlake Corridor project as well. Let's get an update on all the projects and how all the impact from the talk in Washington as well as in Indianapolis is faring with the project. We're turning now to Michael Noland, who is the president of NICTI, which of course runs the South Shore Line. And Mike, thanks for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Hey, thanks for having me, Chris.
Give us an update, if you will, on how the projects are coming along. And I know that we're at a pretty important point here, certainly with the double tracking project and maybe even for the extension of the corridor as well, too.
Yeah, both projects are actually kind of going on at parallel pace right now. We submitted to the Federal Transit Administration last September for project ratings. And we are diligently working to complete the environmental process under the National Environmental Policy Act for both projects. And we expect to get our final, called NEPA, clearance from the FTA, the Federal Transit Administration, here in the next few weeks or month or so. So it's a really important time in the life of the projects to get through NEPA, and to have our projects listed in the FTA's annual report on funding.
I know that even lately here, some of the latest news has come out here is that that is moving ahead very nicely, that the FTA has got the things at least as far as the recommendations are concerned. Of course, recommendations are only that and doesn't necessarily mean that all the funding will come through. And I know that's the next thing that is of the biggest concern, because President Trump has already put out his budget proposal for the next year or so. And he's talking about some major cuts in transportation and some other domestic spending, I guess, to make way for infrastructure. But that's interesting that he would make those changes and then turn this particular project as infrastructure, too.
Yeah, you know, it's not a surprise to us that the president's budget does not have money for our projects. They didn't, for projects that were reviewed last year, mm-hmm. The president didn't submit money for any projects. But we have to step back and remember, presidents recommend consideration for budgets, Congress appropriates. And this, the capital investment grant program that will fund both Westlake and DoubleTrack has been a decades-long, very bipartisan-supported grant program. And when the administration suggested cutting the program last year, both the House and the Senate rejected that recommendation. And we see that there's a lot of projects in the pipeline from both Republican and Democrat-dominated states. And so that gives us comfort as well, that in Congress, where appropriations are going to be made, these programs are going to continue.
Now, I know that we're very lucky, too, in having Northwest Indiana Congressman Pete Visklosky on our side working on the project in particular, too. Are we finding that even some of the Republican legislators are supporting it, too?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You've got projects in Texas, in North Carolina, Florida, Missouri, just to name a few of which are heavily Republican states or went Republican in the last election. And supported the administration that are in the pipeline. So we've got a lot of allies across the country for these types of programs. And so we are very hopeful that that Congress, when they approve the detailed fiscal year 18 budget, we'll have monies in the capital investment grant project to advance the projects that are actually ahead in the line of the line for us, Chris. I mean, we're not asking for money out of federal fiscal year 18. That started October 1st of 2017 and runs through September 30th of this year.
Right.
So there's groups in front of us. We want to make sure that they get funded so that when it's our turn for funding, there's not a big backlog. And we're looking for money out of the fiscal year 19 federal budget that starts October 1st of this year.
Mm-hmm. We started at the outset of our conversation talking about words from Indianapolis, and I know that the Indiana General Assembly is still in session, and they're still dealing with some issues, and I guess just recently, I guess word came down that from the Indiana legislature that the funding for, at least on the state level, for the South Shore Line projects is going through pretty nicely.
Yeah, you know, we got the commitment in the 2017 General Assembly for the double track project, and we got the commitment in 2015 for the Westlake project, and we're working with the Indiana Finance Authority and our fiscal partner, which is the Regional Development Authority of Northwest Indiana. The RDA has been appointed the fiscal agent for these projects, and we're working in lockstep with them and the IFA to make sure that when we go out to market, we get the best possible rating, and the better the rating you get, the lower your cost of debt service. So it's to our advantage to work with the IFA and the RDA for the benefit of everyone to keep the project costs as low as possible.
We're talking with Michael Nolan, who is the president of the South Shore Line, the commuter rail that runs through Northwest Indiana, as the funding process continues on and the project review process also continues in Washington for the upcoming projects. For those who may not be familiar with what the projects are, give us a quick overview, if you will, please, Mike, on first the double tracking.
The double track project is a basically a 25-mile corridor between Michigan City and just to the east of the Gary Metro Station in Gary, where our line is mostly a single-track, one-way railroad running two-way traffic. So what we want to do is add a second track, so we're completely connected with two tracks from Michigan City all the way till we jump on Metra in Chicago, and then we're four tracks all the way into downtown Chicago. Mm-hmm. And so we're going to build about 17 miles of new track, four new bridges, three new stations of high-level platforms. And the idea is that by doing so, we can run express service, we can reduce travel time, we can improve on-time performance, we can run more trains with the same equipment. It's about a $321 million project, and we want to get into the federal fiscal year 2019 budget so we can start construction in 19 and finish in 20.
Yeah, the Westlake Corridor project's a little more involved, and it's different. It's something that I know is new here. We're talking about a route that goes south rather than east and west.
Yeah, the Westlake project really branches off the South Shore Line in North Hammond. It runs down the Illinois-Indiana border on the old Monon Corridor line that Hammond, Munster, and Nickty purchased in 1990 to make sure that someday there'd be an opportunity to run commuter rail on the line. Mm-hmm. It's a greenfield line that is going to be constructed with a lot of structure in North Hammond. We're up in the air, so it's a fairly complicated project. We've got to run over the river. We got to go over several railroad tracks with flyovers. And it's about a $650 million project because everything's going to be brand new. There's nothing existing. Mm-hmm. We're building new track. We're building a new rail yard, new stations, and a lot of structure and a lot of bridges. So that project, we're hoping also to start construction in 19 and finish that up in 2022 to start operations on the Westlake Corridor.
Now, I know this part of the project, I know too, Mike, is one that has brought the most public attention and some concern as to how the route is going to run. Have many of the questions been answered for the residents who might be affected by this particular part of the project?
You know, Chris, we do as much outreach as we can. We're always willing to go and talk to a group. We've been out in the community for many, many meetings. I'm sure there's always somebody that we haven't gotten to, but there's been so much press. There's so much information on our website. If people go to our website, the South Shore, just Google My South Shore Line, it'll pop up. You go to the About section, and we've got detailed information on both projects. That people can take a look at. They can send us questions if they have them. We want the word to get out on exactly what these projects are and answer anybody's questions who may have a comment or concern.
Now, what's the next step now? We're going through the process now, I guess, of the reviews. What seems to be next on the timetable? You mentioned some of the timetables there about the funding in particular and when you'd like the projects, both projects, to get started.
Yeah, we're just about to finish the environmental process, which is a huge milestone. We're working with the FTA now on getting a project rating, and we're one of the things we're doing is making sure that the FTA completely understands the fact that we have 100% of our local financing locked in and in place for both projects, and that's a huge advantage for our projects as compared to other projects at this stage of project development across the country. And so, and our financing isn't a simple package. It involves contributions from cities, the county, RDA, the state of Indiana through the General Assembly, all funneled with assistance from the RDA, funneled through the IFA with some statutes that backstop the funding sources. It's a good diverse array of funding, which I think investors always like to see, and it's going to help us get the highest possible bond rating that's the lowest possible cost of interest. So we want to make sure the FTA completely understands our financing structure and then ask them for a project rating, and we want the highest rating possible, especially if these projects get more and more competitive. We want our projects to rate the highest as compared to our fellow project sponsors across the country.
That's the update on the two major projects before the South Shore Line. And Mike Nolan, thanks very much for the update.
All right. Thanks, Chris.
Mike Nolan is the president of NICTY, which, of course, stands for the Northern Indiana Commuter Transportation District, which runs the South Shore Line. A federal court judge denied East Chicago residents' request to intervene in court proceedings concerning lead contamination at a public housing complex there. Judge Philip Simon's ruling agrees with the prior magistrate judge's opinion, saying that the request was made too late in the process. Attorney Debbie Chiweezer works with the residents in the Superfund area, and she says that while the motion to intervene did cause the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency to take action more quickly at the site, residents are still concerned.
There are still many outstanding issues at the site, including contaminated groundwater, outstanding indoor lead dust issues, and many properties that still need to be cleaned.
Weiser also says that residents still have to plan to make their voices heard, even if they aren't able to do so in the courtroom.
Every week, residents are going to be raising their voices and pressuring EPA and the polluters to do a better job to protect the health of the community.
Residents and advocacy groups originally had filed for intervention in 2016, arguing that the recent developments at the USS Lead Superfund site, along with changes in the remediation process, in turn should let them be able to make a role possible in the court proceedings. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. On this Wednesday, here's the host of Green Fleet Radio, Carl Lissick.
Well, thank you for that introduction, and today our guest is Mr. Mitch Barloga. He's the Transportation Planning Manager for the Northwestern Indiana Regional Planning Commission, or NERPC. Mitch, welcome to the show.
Carl, great to be on again. Thank you.
Well, Mitch, South Shore Clean Cities has a longstanding relationship with NERPC. Tell our listeners what NERPC is and what it does.
NERPC is the three-county Metropolitan Planning Organization for Lake, Porter, and LaPorte. We are regional government. I tell people we are kind of the phantom government. People don't know what we do, but we're there. We don't really have any type of regulatory authority over the region. I basically say we advise and inspire.
Sure.
We put out plans because it's in our name, and we try to get our region, local officials, advocates alike, to really plan for what's best in this area.
Were you talking? You're talking about plans. I know NERPC has released the draft of the Greenways and Blueways, or 2020 plan. So what topic does that plan cover?
It's a mix. You know, it's one of those deals where you have chocolate and peanut butter and they taste great together. Well, so does conservation and non-motorized transportation, apparently. Because these are the two areas of strong planning focus we've had in our office for many years. We've done separate plans in the past, and so we decided to kind of bring it all together under this one document. So it's three major categories of conservation, recreation, and transportation, and how these are interrelated and all really work together.
So, you know, based on that unique focus, how do you correctly blend all those topics together?
Well, that's the trick. How do we correctly blend? We take the plan and we kind of break down all these individual components and we bring out what they mean in our particular region. And then we do an integration chapter where we talk about how they do come together. And then we have a very involved implementation chapter. We take the many goals and objectives from the plan, we break them down into policies and action steps, and we spread it along eight major stakeholder groups in the region that can apply each of these objectives at their own certain level. And those, let me just say, those include just not all eight, but you got corporate property owners, and you got federal government, you got private property owners. Basically, Carl, everyone falls into these eight categories.
Sure. And so how do people get involved with this, Mitch?
Well, we ask them, you know, we're always putting out, you know, we have a very good presence on social media. Mm-hmm. We invite people to our meetings constantly. We get the word out, and we have a lot of, as you know, meetings. We almost live to meet over there.
Sure.
And what we try to do is within the document themselves, we make it very easy for a particular person, no matter where they are in the spectrum of users and stakeholders. Like, okay, you have an institution of education. You are a grade school. How can you be part of the Greenways and Blueways planning work? And there is a chart to make that work out, because a lot of these plans, as you well know, are technical. And
they are.
You kind of get lost in the jargon, and you're like, how do I get involved? We're trying to make that more user-friendly.
Sure. And I think, as you know, as an environmentalist, we want to see things easier for people to add their comment. And again, this is our home.
Yes.
And we want to make it better. So, as you talk about the plan, when do you expect it to be approved?
We're looking at a public comment period now that we had commenced last week.
And okay.
That'll be for 30 days to about March 2nd. And then we have an open house at NERPC on February 15th from 5 to 7 p.m. So the public can come and talk to us personally. But again, the plan is online right now on our website, NERPC.org, and it's open for public comment. There are ways of emailing and calling us. And we're hoping to get this all wrapped up in a approved in March.
Wonderful. That's exciting. And mm-hmm. So with the Greenways and Blueways projects, what do you see moving forward in 2018?
There is quite a few things going on. Last year was a bit of a slow year, and I look back and I put together the list of what got accomplished, and it really wasn't slow after all. We did get quite a few things done. But major accomplishments that we're looking to work through this year, we have a new bike map coming on online, updating the Greenways and Blueways map, which is bicycling, walking, pedestrian routes, and paddling. And so we'll get that done. And we're also going to start working on signing our trails, putting up wayfinding where people at least know what community they're riding in and they know what streets they're crossing. And, of course, that helps out just in the sense of pride. Hey, I went five communities today.
No, absolutely.
On one ride. Mm-hmm. Or I'm having a heart attack. What community am I in? And I said, don't mean to be morbid about it, but, I mean, you need to know for emergency services. Mm-hmm. Even if it's not that serious, maybe you just twist an ankle, but, hey, I need some help here. So that's very good. It's been a multi-community effort. We're working on the Erie-Lackawanna Trail and the Prairie Dunland Trail. So that's 10 communities we're trying to bring under one umbrella. Again, that shows you what NERPC does. We try to reach across these jurisdictional boundaries, break down the walls, and have each of our communities work together. And then there's just several different projects that we're hoping to come online, probably the largest of which is the Singing Sands Trail in Michigan City.
Okay.
Finally, it's been on the books for almost 14 years. And we're looking to get that starting probably as early as May.
Sure. You know, you're talking a lot about these different trails and just different things that you're working on, the bike maps. How is technology improving, and how are you implementing this into all these different plans?
It's really fascinating right now. I mean, we understand that we can just get traffic reports off of Google, not to give them a free plug, right? But Google's become a verb in it now. But Google Maps, where you can find out where all the hotspots are. And we're finding out, also how many people are out there using our trails. We have trail counters throughout our region.
Okay.
And those are infrared beams that do nothing but count your movement. So they're not taking your credit card information. So I've had that question before. So we're going to either get a person running through, or we're going to get maybe a deer running through, but we're getting a good count of all those through that process. And of course, working with other groups, like reading off of maybe even Fitbits or their phones. Again, these are things that people sign up
for. It's exciting. Yeah.
It is. And so you can really find out who's doing what where.
Any big events that our listeners should be aware of? I know you talked about the open houses, but anything else coming up in spring, summer this year?
Well, events throughout the year, we have the usual events in regards to bicycling, night rides, and the like that are happening. Again, we hope to get the map out, and we're hoping to even get a larger cornucopia out there where we bring all the people together, the jurisdictions that have federal projects in the pipeline, and to talk about their progress and their future construction.
Sure. Any closing thoughts for our listeners as we wrap up our program?
It's never too cold to be outside, although this might be one of those days. But if, opening day for trails is sometime in April, and hopefully they'll take advantage.
Wonderful. Mitch, as always, thank you for being on our show. And that will do it for today's edition of Green Fleet Radio. Thank you again to Mr. Mitch Barloga, Transportation Planning Manager of the Northwestern Indiana Regional Planning Commission. Green Fleet Radio airs three times every Wednesday on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm your host, Carl Lissick. Thanks for joining us. And remember, it's never too late to begin your environmental legacy. Thank you.
Carl Lissick, the host of Green Fleet Radio, which is made possible by South Shore Clean Cities. You can hear Green Fleet Radio every Wednesday here on Regionally Speaking, and the podcasts of Green Fleet Radio are also available online on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, as well as on NPR One. Just search for WLPR. Indiana can move forward with lethal injections following an Indiana Supreme Court ruling that sanctions the state's use of a new lethal injection drug. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports on the outcome of a lawsuit that revolved around the state's rulemaking authority.
The Department of Correction chose a new lethal injection drug cocktail in 2014, a combination never before used in this country. Death Row inmate Roy Ward sued, arguing the DOC should have used an administrative rulemaking process required by state law and open to public comment. And since it didn't, the state can't use the drug. But a unanimous ruling from the state Supreme Court disagrees. Justice Christopher Goff writes the DOC's decision to use a new drug cocktail doesn't create a new rule, the kind that would require that public process. Instead, Goff says choosing the drug is an internal policy change that only affects DOC procedure, not any inmates. Ward's execution has not been scheduled. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
This is Regionally Speaking. Lakeshore Focus host Keith Kirkpatrick recently talked with two people who are very familiar with the effort of preparing youth for the working world. Here's the conversation.
Do you remember your first job or your second? Do you recall the best boss you ever had or the time you got chewed out or fired? How about the moment at work where you felt you were part of the team, vital to success? For better or worse, our youth, starting as young as 10 through their early 20s, engage in work experiences that shape who they are, how they feel about themselves, and how effective they will be as an employee or worker. Today, I have two people who are dedicated to helping young people have productive opportunities and learning what it takes to succeed in the world of work. First, Kathy Holum, who serves as a manager for a program called Jobs for America's Graduates within our Work One system, and Mike Baird, who sits on the Northwest Indiana Youth Employment Council, having been a previous chair, but also a former bank president and past CEO for the Boys and Girls Clubs of Lake County. Glad to have both of you guys on the show today.
Good to be here.
Thank you. Thank
yeah, you and you us. And you look so good. That's what I just have to say.
Thank you very much, Keith. I appreciate that.
I see Mike on a regular basis, and he doesn't always necessarily look this good. But today, you cleaned up really well.
No blue and khakis.
That's true. From the old days, right?
Yeah.
So we're going to talk a little bit about youth today. And so let me start with you, Kathy. I mean, you've worked with kids for a long time, mm-hmm. right? I mean, so where did you kind of first start working with kids?
I first started working with kids when my son was a year old. He was what was called medically fragile. He had asthma, so I couldn't put him in daycare. So I decided to start a daycare, and my passion working with kids just kind of blossomed from there. I went on to start after-school programs and eventually get involved with the JAG program.
So you're even an entrepreneur.
Absolutely, yes.
Oh, wow. So you've kind of worked the business side and you work the helping side. So you spend a lot of time around young people.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I have.
Mike, these past few years, kind of after you stepped out of the presidency of the bank and working in banking for years, you kind of jumped in starting to work with kids. What got you into starting to spend more time with younger people?
Well, I really had a passion for trying to help disadvantaged kids in particular. I had experiences in banking with several of the nonprofit community development organizations in some of the disadvantaged areas of Lake County, and recognized the difficult living situations a lot of the families had there, and then the kids. So it was an opportunity for me to try to find ways that I could get more involved.
And you've done some real one-on-one stuff too with kids, because you worked at one of the high schools for a year, just kind of helping kids understand more about their careers, right?
Well, I had probably one of the greatest experiences of my life. I was an AmeriCorps member and had the opportunity to spend a year at Calumet High School, New Tech, as a career counselor, and got to work with kids, helping them think through what their career choices might be, talking about what their interests were, trying to help them, as freshmen in particular, think about what they needed to do for the next 4 years of high school to be better prepared to graduate and either go find a job or get additional training or college.
So what a great opportunity for them to have someone like you with your background to be right there on site talking with those kids, but probably you both learn a lot working with kids today. So as you spent the time with some of our kids today, what do you think what do they seem not to grasp or have a really tough time trying to understand about work and experience and things? Kathy, what's kind of tough for them?
Our kids, our youth right now, are very smart. They have just maybe some difficulties gaining the experience, seems to be the biggest obstacle that I see with the kids that I work with.
Do you think they understand the value of the experience?
Some do and some don't. I mean, it's really hard to say. Some really do. Some will have those babysitting jobs and mowing grass and just know that working in itself is good. Some want to focus on their schoolwork and don't really see the value in actually having employment. So we try to let them know that you need this experience, that this will make you a well-rounded individual, that learning from an actual job opportunity is going to help you just as much as what you read in a book.
Mike, when you talk to kids, what's the one thing you're trying to convey to them that they need to understand that maybe you think, I'm not sure they're really getting this yet?
Well, what I certainly learned when I was at Calumet High School, many of the kids really didn't start to think about what the future looked like. They don't have any visual of what work life might be, what career opportunities existed for them. And so a major part of the conversation was just to get them to start to think about what things they were interested in, what kinds of things they might like to do with their life, and then to start to put some reference points together so they could identify what some opportunities might be that match their interests.
Let me ask you this, because it's kind of a reaction. I sometimes think we as adults do a disservice to kids, being one of our first questions is, what are you going to do when you grow up? Do you agree with that? I think we're asking them, you need to decide right. It's like you need to decide right now. Did you know what you were going to do when you were 16 and 17?
No, absolutely not. And I tell kids that I work with, think of everything as just forward motion. Maybe you'll do something for 2 years that'll help you with your ultimate goal. Maybe you'll go to college for 4 years and move on to something else. But as long as there's forward motion is really what I preach to my kids, that you're always bettering yourself, getting more knowledge, looking at all the opportunities, and just constantly moving forward. You will never have to settle into one specific career or occupation. I've worked in so many, being on the business side, being in retail, being in management, and then also working in youth services. And I'm passionate about all of them, and I've just been blessed to continue to educate myself and now help children find kind of what they're passionate about and just continue to learn, just always learn.
Well, Mike, you ask a really good question. Well, go, you say, I just want to know what you're interested in. You try to find out their interest. How do you do that?
Well, it's talking about them. What do they like to do? Are they in sports? Do they like working with people? Are they more comfortable working independently somewhere? So just trying to get them to express what interests them. Kathy makes a great point. I think a lot of kids are really struggling trying to figure out what that might be that really excites them when they're a freshman in high school. Or younger.
I want to know for both of you, what's your answer? Because I think this is a typical answer for a lot of young people. What do you like to do? I like to text my friends. I like to play games. I like to hang out with my friends. What's your response to that?
I would say the ability to be social is going to be necessary in a lot of occupations. The ability to use technology, again, just so many occupations need that. And even though those are hobbies right now and just things they enjoy, just that they have the skill set to use technology and that they have the willingness to go out in crowds or to, you know, be social, those are huge assets that they're going to have depending on which career they want to go into. They're just all great personality traits.
Is that kind of the direction you would go to, or how do you kind of take it to that next step?
You know, it's really hard to generalize. I had a really interesting experience this past weekend. We were out for to dinner with some friends, and their freshman at college, their son was along, and he had been very interested in coding all through school, and he was developing games and putting them online, torturing my wife and me, trying to help us learn how to use these games, which was very difficult since I have no hand-eye coordination. But anyway, he was telling us about a business that he started, entrepreneurial, and he's taking his coding into developing an app that will go out and search online. He's now developed a business where he's selling, reselling a high-end product. He will find somebody who has one of these for sale and identify it online with his app and then repackage it and mark it at a markup, very nice markup given the value of these products. And he's made a very nice little business while he's in college. And so there's kids out there right now that are using technology in all these exciting, innovative ways that I couldn't begin to understand. But so there's those kids that are out there really out in front of what's happening in the technology side. Then we have the other kids who are still trying to figure out what they're going to do. And Kathy's point about they're probably going to have to get comfortable with learning the rest of their life, and many of them are already tired of school when they're in high school. So it's also trying to recognize the challenge many of our kids have now to recognize what the future is going to look like, and the jobs are going to be continually changing. I think we all say now that Absolutely. The jobs that we're training them for today may not even exist, or the jobs that we want to educate them for won't be there when they graduate from whatever programs they go to.
Let me ask you, if you can explain the disconnect on this. I was just at one of the high schools this morning doing junior achievement, and we were talking about careers to freshmen in high school. And I asked the question, so how many of you plan on continuing your education? I didn't say go to college. I said continue your education past high school. There was still in the room several who didn't raise their hand at all, you know, and some who kind of did this little, you know, shorthand thing. And I'm thinking 25% of you in here to nearly a third don't still really grasp how important it is to get an education past high school. How is that message? What's happening that they don't get that?
Well, I think Kathy in the JAG program.
You're working with them all the time. Why don't they get that?
I think they get it. I think they're intimidated. I think they feel that if they decide on a major right now, that's what they're locked into. I don't think they understand that it's a stepping stone. And then the other thing is we are seeing an increase in more of those hands-on jobs, the skilled trades where they can go into apprenticeships and still learn. And it's not a college-based learning or a classroom setting. And I think there's a lot of value to those also that kids are beginning to see and considering. So it's not that they're not interested in college per se or that type of format of learning. It's just that they know there's other opportunities that have a lot of options for them also.
That's really an interesting observation, that commitment to continuing education past high school is a two-step process. One, you just have to say, I'm going to do that. And the second is then I'll figure out what I'm going to do. But I think you're right. They probably think, well, I need to know what I'm going to do in order to make that commitment. Mm-hmm. So as adults, we can maybe help them understand you don't have to commit to going to college or a major or an apprenticeship program or anything right now. Just commit to doing it. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
Yeah, and that's the challenge I think many of the schools are really wrestling with. How do we help the kids identify what those options are? It's like we were saying earlier, how do I figure out what my passion is when I'm 15 years old? And the idea, there was a great test, and I think it's been discontinued, but ACT used to have a test that some of our schools were giving in freshmen, and the output was not only academic skills, but it also asked questions that got some of their social interests, and the output was included something that was called the world of work. And I thought it was a very, very powerful tool to help kids identify what their interests, social interests and so forth, might lead them to consider for careers. And then this world of work divided the world into quadrants that if you really seem to enjoy working with people, here are some careers you might want to think about. If you tend to want to work in with your hands, here's some other careers you might want to think about. And then it had a list of what some of these might be, and it was just a tremendous discussion tool for me as a career counselor and for them to take home and talk to their parents about.
Well, you've made me think about the second question that's not really not a good one. The first one is, you know, what are you going to major in? What do you want to be when you grow up? And you're asking 16. We've already concluded we didn't know that. None of us. Right. I think we've now substituted that with probably another bad question, which is, what are you passionate about? Do you know what you were passionate about 16 that you can say on public television?
Well, I was just thinking, probably not. But,
I mean, most kids, I mean, I don't know what I was passionate about that age. Do you?
I always felt drawn to teach and work with kids, I think, okay. Ever since I was young.
But would you call that a passion for yourself at that point in time?
No, I guess not passionate, but I was kind of drawn. It was my primary interest then.
So again, I think this trying to explore. Let's talk a little bit about this work ethics thing, because, you know, Mike, you're on this Youth Employment Council, and you started this initiative, gosh, 15 years ago, I think, when you were chairing. First of all, what is work ethics? What are we trying to teach when we say kids need good work ethics?
Well, one of the things that we're talking about, the soft skills that virtually all of us need, regardless what we're going to be doing with our lives. It's skills we need in school. It's those life skills, as Mike Berta would like to call them, like showing up to work on time, listening to instructions, following instructions, good listening habits, dressing properly. I have a poster here, may I?
Yeah. This is a poster I think you've been using. Why don't you hold that up? So maybe our audience could take a look at that. While he's showing that, Kathy, I mean, are these things real important? I know you've seen this poster many times, right?
Absolutely. Very
why
important.
Why are these things so important?
It's just the basis of your life skills, of anything going forward, work, having a family, raising your own future family. And a lot of times some of the youth that I work with may have not had good modeling in their families. So it's trying to show them a different way to live their lives, to be more successful, to not have those struggles that maybe they've seen in their own families. And just showing them how much they can be, helping with their self-esteem, helping with their confidence. And these are all things that will make them successful in the community and successful for themselves.
How do you address that issue? And a good point. I mean, on here, it's you manage your time effectively, you know, show up on time. Mm-hmm. How do you overcome the fact that they see their parents not doing those, or people in adult roles in their life who don't pay any attention to those things? They don't show up on time, they don't manage their time well,
right?
And that's what they see.
We try to illustrate people who do have good time management and how it plays into their success and what they're able to accomplish, and use those as the examples. We never, you know, I don't know anybody else's struggle and what anybody else has been through, so we never want to say they're doing it wrong, obviously, but we want to show, well, let's say you are able to get to work on time and how much better you're going to do, and if your employer can count on you for all those things that you need to do during the course of the day without calling out sick or having an excuse not to work, just how much more successful you're going to be. So we just try to highlight all the people that are very successful in their community. A lot of times we'll have other employers come in and speak with our classrooms, tell them, you know, their feel, what they look for in employees, and we do a lot of mentoring, just a lot of positive influences. We try to keep the
kids going. Need these kind of things.
Absolutely.
Mike, you've hired in your lifetime, in your career, all kinds of people, young ones, older ones, and so forth. And I know you and I have both heard this phrase, hey, just give me somebody with a good attitude and has some of these basic work ethics, I can train them to do the job. Mm-hmm. Is that really true?
Well, I think it is. I mean, these 10 skills that we have on that poster were developed over, we've done, I think we, Center of Workforce Innovations, has done three surveys over the span of the last 15 years, surveying over 100 businesses in Northwest Indiana. And these 10 skills have consistently come back as the most important skills that employers are looking for in people that are coming to work for them. And the, as you said, Keith, they are generally able to teach them the technical aspects, but just having the discipline to show up to work on time, positive attitude. I mean, just, I don't know about you, but I really enjoy going into a restaurant and having a good experience with the wait person. I always like to recognize, I hope Jeannie doesn't see this, my wife, but if I am in a McDonald's, just getting a cup of coffee, I would never, or in a Wendy's.
You're just kind of making that up because you probably don't go to those places.
I can't go to Wendy's or McDonald's very often. But if they smile when they're giving me my coffee and look like they're having a good day, I'll try to recognize them for it. Point out that that smile is really a nice way for me to start my day with my cup of coffee. And I think it's something that each one of us can do. Mm-hmm. If we see some young person in one of those fast food restaurants or whatever.
Or wherever they're working.
Or wherever they're working, yeah, doing a good job. Well, take a second and just say something to them and recognize that they're appreciated for what they're doing.
One of the things, Kathy, I think adults don't understand, or both of you, that these work experiences that young people get can happen any place. I mean,
absolutely,
and anytime they're helping an adult and doing something, whether they get paid or not, mm-hmm, it's kind of a work experience. What do we say to adults, both of you, what do we say to adults to say to enhance that experience? Because I think a lot of times adults are afraid to give feedback or talk to kids and reinforce this stuff. How can they reinforce these things?
Definitely by demonstrating them themselves, obviously, making sure their staff is all on the same page, making sure that they're consistent with discipline across the board with all the other employees. And then, again, parents just making sure that they're demonstrating the best they can, all those good work ethics and good skills, good life
skills.
Mike,
one of the things you're saying is the greatest thing is continue to compliment them on these things.
Yeah, nothing better than positive reinforcement. Trying to observe the behavior that you're expecting or hoping they would demonstrate, and then saying something. We all think about money as obviously the incentive that we work, but I've always been pleasantly surprised in my world of managing how many employees are just very happy just to have a thank you for a great job or being recognized. So I think that's something we can all do.
Well, let me ask real quick, Kathy, if you have the opposite side, you have a student, a young person who is not practicing these, so there's nothing to compliment.
Okay.
They're doing the opposite. What do you do to kind of instruct them that they need to be doing it differently?
So what we do with JobWorks and JAG would be, if we have a student who's having some difficulties, is we coach them on how they can improve those behaviors, set up kind of an action plan, let them know what the rewards are for improving those behaviors, whether it's just complimenting them when they achieve their goals, or maybe they work a little harder at work and get a raise, get promoted, just all the opportunities and possibilities that are out there, just for improving their work ethic. And again, Mike said, complimenting them when they do something successful, making a big deal about it for them is huge, because a lot of people do need the pat on the back, especially if they're not getting that regularly. So,
well, I really appreciate both of you being here and sharing these thoughts. I really hope both young people and older people who are watching this will gain something from it. I know, Mike, we're trying to get more service clubs and adults to hire kids. We need more kids, more adults to give feedback to kids, and I hope that we've got kids who will take some of these messages and become more successful, because they're going to be taking care of us in our old age, right?
Absolutely.
That's what we always say?
We hope so. And and appreciate your having us here today to be able to talk about some of these programs that we're involved in.
Absolutely. Great.
Well, thanks a lot. Appreciate you being here.
Thank you very much.
Lecture Focus airs on Friday nights at 7:30 and is rebroadcast on Sunday mornings at 9:30 on Lakeshore PBS. Lori Latham from Smoke Free in the G came into the Regionally Speaking studio recently to talk about the broad coalition of organizations, local, statewide, and national, that are spearheading the effort to protect Gary residents from the dangers of secondhand smoke. Lori starts out our conversation with the group's name. Well, how did you come up with that?
About a half an hour, we toyed around with it in a room. You know, there's a lot of smoke-free cities. Smoke-free New Orleans, smoke-free Baton Rouge, and most of the cities just use that smoke-free. South Bend, or they use the name of the city in the name. So we toyed around with Smoke Free Gary. It didn't quite come together, but most people from Gary, when you say you're from Gary, you say, I'm from the G. I'm from the G, wherever you go. So
well,
Smoke Free in the G.
That's great. The information that I have talks about the number of partners that are involved with Smoke Free in the G.
Yes.
Let's go down the list, talk about these partners and how they fit in with the organization.
Sure. We're a very broad coalition. Most of these are state reps, but we also have some national partners. Mm-hmm. So the state rep from the American Heart Association, American Lung Association, American Cancer Society. We call those the organ organizations.
Right.
But then there's also the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids, Americans for Non-Smokers' Rights, our Indiana State Department of Health Tobacco Prevention and Cessation Agency, and then our partners here locally, our Lake County Community Tobacco Prevention Coalition, which is actually led by Franciscan Health, and then our Northwest our Lake County Minority Tobacco Prevention and Cessation Coalition, and their lead agency is the Northwest Indiana Health Department Cooperative. So a lot of different health partners coming together. And even on those local coalitions, there's a number of other organizations that have also partnered with us on this campaign.
I know one in particular that you've got listed here is the Tobacco-Free Lake County, Indiana.
Yes, Tobacco-Free Lake County, Indiana. That's our community coalition. It's a number of groups who are in that coalition, all partnered for healthier Northwest Indiana.
Now, many of these organizations, like the American Lung Association, American Heart Association, are longstanding. They're decades-long organizations. These others sound like they're relatively young ones?
Well, actually, the other organizations came about after the Master Settlement Agreement, I believe in 1991. Mm-hmm. In 2001, about 10 years later, the state of Indiana in our legislature created a Tobacco Prevention and Cessation Agency. That agency then administered grants to all 92 counties in the state of Indiana, and 29 counties that had significant minority populations also was funded to coordinate a minority coalition. So the local coalitions have actually been around for about 17 years. Mm-hmm. This is our first crack at a policy campaign or a comprehensive secondhand smoke ordinance. But things like tobacco-free campuses, getting our schools to adopt policies, all came out of the Tobacco-Free Lake County. Our public housing units, East Chicago was one of the first, even before they passed the federal law, and that came out of our local Minority Tobacco Prevention Coalition. So a lot of work has been done over the last 17 years to build up for Lake County to completely quit smoking.
I know you mentioned in particular about the funds from the tobacco settlement being allocated here in Indiana, and I know that one of the people most seriously and closely involved in that is a representative Charlie Brown from Gary. That was his major work in getting things started. And I think that was one of the first things that got him started, that in turn led to his continuing effort until about 3 or 4 years ago to get a statewide smoking ban.
Exactly. We call Representative Charlie Brown the godfather of tobacco control. He pretty much started it in the state. And Indiana was a model state throughout the country for its use of tobacco settlement dollars. We were one of the few states that allocated a large portion of the dollars to go toward preventing smoking and to help people quit smoking also. So, yes, he's been he's just been very instrumental throughout the state on a number of public health causes, particularly tobacco prevention and cessation.
Now we know, and he's made the announcement to such, and he's told us as such on the air, that this coming legislative session starting in January is going to be his last. He's decided not
Don't
to run for re-election.
Don't make me cry, Chris.
There are a lot of people that are very disappointed. But he did say that he was going to do the push, and he was hoping that his colleagues in the Indiana House, and hopefully with some support in the Indiana Senate, will make the changes that he had hoped would originally have happened, but he had to see go into the statewide smoking ban, the exemption.
Mm-hmm, right.
And he's going to do his best to see that there's a revised smoking ban without the different exemptions
for, because right now casinos have been exempted. I spoke with Representative Charlie Brown, and I told him, you know, in order for him to go, for him to go downstate, because what they've charged him with the entire time he's been down there is that he's from a casino community. Mm-hmm. And you're asking the entire state to do something that you haven't been able to get done in your own hometown. And that's exactly what they told us a few years ago when the state passed that policy, that we won't preempt local communities from passing stronger ordinances. And if you get a couple of those local communities to pass something stronger, perhaps there'll be more support throughout the state.
That's Lori Latham from Smoke Free and the G. And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for being with us. It's Reporters Roundtable Thursday tomorrow. Mark Chase and Carmen McCullum from The Times and Carol Carlson from The Post-Tribune will join us. And we'll also have from the Mac Foundation, Selena Weatherwax. We hope you'll join us.